Why don't we say a prayer? God, we're thankful for this time of the year. It can be a lot of fun. You also know it can be a lot of stress. God, we ask that in all the fun and all the stress, you would help us see even clearer this year what it was you did 2,000 years ago that we're remembering right now. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Ryan talked last weekend during this series. We're talking about that the story of Christmas is a story of a hero. Story of a hero that came crashing into the world. But it was also the story of a world that was waiting for a hero. It's a story of both. You know, the world at the time, 2,000 years ago, ancient Palestine, was a world of great oppression. And the Jewish people were enslaved in their own homeland. And so they were waiting. They were waiting with this anticipation. They were waiting for relief. They were waiting for release. They were waiting for freedom. They were waiting for their Messiah to come and free them. They were waiting for this hero. And so the story of Christmas, we sometimes can miss, is that it's such a story from the very beginning that it's a story of waiting. Now, some of us in some way, you know, kind of realize this. Those of us that have any kind of church in our background, you might know this time of the year as the Advent season. You heard that term, the Advent season? Anybody know what that means? Advent, the Advent season? Anyone? It means something's coming. Something's coming. It's mean that we are anticipating something. We are waiting on something. We are anticipating something. We are anticipating the celebration of the nativity. So from the very beginning, the roots of this, that it's about waiting. Now, you actually don't have to have any kind of church background to associate this time of the year with waiting, though. I know, you know, for most of us, when I look back on this, you know, my childhood, it was, yeah, it was about opening presents, but it was just as much about the waiting. It was about the anticipation of opening the presents. It was about the waiting. It was the anticipation of when is the last day of school before Christmas break? When is that going to come? You know, when are the presents going to come out, you know, in this waiting? When are we going to get to open the presents? You know, there's this waiting. And the waiting was so much a part of the experience for me as a kid. And, you know, often kids don't do well with waiting. I was okay with it. But my brother Randy, oh, boy, wow, waiting would almost kill him every year. And what you need to know about my brother Randy is he I guess at the time they would say he had ants in his pants, you know, or that he had a lot of energy. Boy, that little boy has a lot of energy, you know, or he's high strung, you know. These are all words before Ritalin was in our vocabulary, you know, Randy had a lot of energy, And so waiting for him was particularly difficult when it came to the presents, and seeing him at Christmas, watching him tear into his gifts was just an experience of awe and utter violence. It was just so intense the way he would just kind of tear, he would plunge into them. He would get, you know, not just, you know, kind of rip the paper off like a lot of us would do, but he would plunge through the paper, through the cardboard of the box, tear his own hole, and then pull out of it, you know, whatever. I had forgotten about it, and I was reminded of it. Family and I, we went to the zoo for Halloween this year. And anybody that's ever seen the silverback gorilla there, first of all, it's a thing of awe. You've got to see the silverback gorilla at the zoo. But to watch the silverback gorilla tear into a pumpkin, pulling his treat out of it, same kind of attitude and tone of my brother Randy kind of tearing into the gifts. And what he would do is he would tear into the gifts, plunge through the cardboard, pull it out. If it needed to be put together, he would immediately cram it together, and then he would start playing with it. And he would play with it immediately so feverishly and so intensely for about 3 to 4 minutes until it broke. And then he would throw it down, and then he would open the next present. And then kind of the same thing. And he just saw it. So his thing was, whenever he got a gift, he would kind of pull it up, and he would play with it really feverishly and shake it until it broke, and then on to the next thing. You can imagine our concern when he and his wife had their first child. You know, we were praying, and it turned out okay so far. So for us around our house, Christmas, it was a time of waiting. It was this anticipation and this waiting. And that was the original story here. That was the world that this baby love came crashing into, was that it was a world that was waiting. It was a world that was waiting. Now, anybody that knows anything about the history of that time, the big dog on the world stage was Rome. Rome was ruling, you know, most of the known world at the time. It was a time that became known as the Pax Romana. A Pax Romana, the time of Roman peace, because of the relative stability in the world that had been achieved because of Rome's ruling. And, you know, it's hard to get, you know, kind of a grip on how powerful Rome was on the world stage at the time. But if you could kind of keep in your mind, like today, think of a metaphor today might be, if you could combine all the power and all the resources of the United States and China and the New England Patriots, you know, and you put those... put those three to... Not a lot of Patriot fans in here, huh? Yeah. Hey, I'm still with the Bengals. Still a Bengal fan. Got to be honest, I'm in a bad place right now with them. Not doing well. I'm not doing well. I think it's going to work out okay, but... Rome, though. Rome. Well, I almost lost it. I almost had to pray and send you home there. I didn't know where we were going with it. Rome was this incredible... So Rome had occupied this area of Palestine since about 63 BC, the Pax Romana. And incredible things were achieved during the Pax Romana. I mean, inventions like indoor plumbing, indoor heating, these roads, all this incredible art that was done and all these things. And there was a small price to pay for it, though. All that stuff came at the expense of this incredibly oppressive taxation system, the enslavement of people, the torturing and killing of people, throwing the occasional person to the lion, you know, that kind of stuff. But hey, you know what? When history looks back at this period, what did they say the combination of all that was? Peace. It was the Pax Romana. Yeah, it was peace. It was peace. It was also an awful lot of oppression for the people that were being ruled over. So this world at the time was a world that was waiting. These people were waiting for relief, waiting for release, waiting for a hero to come. Well, almost all the world. See, there was a sliver that wasn't waiting, because they didn't have to wait for anything. This was the sliver that somehow was in the good graces of the Roman Empire. This is the sliver of people that were able to rule over everybody else and keep things in line for Rome. One of the people, toward the very top of that sliver, was a guy named Herod. Herod. Now, what you need to know at the time was the way Rome achieved this peace was they were smart. They would identify certain people in each local area that could be kind of their henchmen, that could be kind of their strong man there, would be a governor of that area that would keep people in line, make sure the taxes were paid, and just kind of keep all the order. And so they had these people that are kind of governors in this area. So Herod, some way, through family connections, through other kind of backwater dealing or whatever, Herod had weaseled his way into the good graces of Caesar at the time. And so Mark Antony had appointed Herod to be kind of the ruler of this area. And he had even officially given him the title King of the Jews. King of the Jews. So Herod was king of the Jews and he was ruling over this area. That's why, toward the very beginning of the Christmas story, it sets it up in this way in Matthew. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem, in Judea, during the time of King Herod. During the time of King Herod. The very time was named after him. Was all the perspective around King Herod. The very time was named after him. I mean, it's almost, you know, like we talk about, you know, the NBA in the late 80s and 90s. During the time of Michael Jordan. You know, as, you know, that kind of thing. Or maybe they'll refer 100 years back, you know, maybe they'll look back. 2007, 2008. Oh yeah, during the time of Brian Wells. This kind of... No, but imagine that. Imagine if time would be referred to by you. You would frame time. That is how powerful, and that's the resources that King Herod, the great, Herod the Great, they called him. So we see that that's the framework for this, and we pick up the Christmas story here. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who's been born King of the Jews?" Ooh, probably not the right terminology to use with Herod. "Where's the one who's been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, the all Jerusalem with him was just simply because Herod was known as the kind of guy was if he was disturbed, you were going to be disturbed. You know, it was a problem. If Herod had a problem, everybody had a problem. Now, you look at this and you wonder, excuse me, with all of his resources, with all of his power that he had, why would Herod be disturbed? What could possibly disturb Herod the Great? He had everything he needed. He didn't have to wait for anything. Well, you need to know a little bit more about at that time what Herod knew. See, he knew that while he had control, while he had been given the title by Mark Antony, King of the Jews, and he had control and they were doing what he said, they only did what he said because it was at penalty of torture or death. Because he knew that to the Jews, the only rightful king, the only right person who could have the title King of the Jews was someone who had descended from the immediate bloodline of King David. And so that he knew to these Jewish people, he was an illegitimate ruler. He was an illegitimate ruler. That if someone ever came along that had a rightful claim to the throne and was rightful within the lineage of King David, there would be a problem. And so Herod awoke every morning with all these resources, all this power, all this might, not needing to wait for anything. And he also awoke in a state of paranoia. Because he knew just under the surface of all this control that he had achieved was this bubbling insurrection. Because they were waiting. They were waiting for the rightful hero to come along. And so that he knew that. And so that's why we know from history, Herod was so incredibly paranoid. And he took incredible steps to make sure that all he had accumulated. See, Herod was all about the right now. If he couldn't have something right now, it was worthless. He had no perspective of eternity. It was all about right now. And he was paranoid about losing whatever he had accumulated in the right now. He was paranoid about his family, for instance. Because if he died, then somebody else would inherit his throne. So he was paranoid about what their motivations might be around him. So what we know from history was that various times during his rule, Herod murdered several of his brother-in-laws, one of his uncles, and his mother-in-law. Killed them all. Now some of you have family coming for Christmas, don't you? No ideas here. The only thing you might want to take from that if you're going to visit people is that you can't push them too far, okay? So maybe 2 days might be your limit, you know. Herod was so paranoid. At another point, what happened when he came to the end of his life, when he was on his deathbed, he knew the maniacal way he had ruled. No one was going to mourn for the passing of this tyrant. So what he did was he ordered all these leaders in the area, all these community leaders, he ordered them all rounded up and held within one place. And then the minute that he passed away, the order was that they were all to be murdered. So at least there'd be some kind of mourning going on in the land. That's this kind of guy. That's this kind of guy that was clinging to this throne. So he was disturbed. He was disturbed. When the fact is, if he had learned to wait, if he had waited, he would have learned that, yes, this baby love that had been born was the rightful king. But he didn't want his stuff. He didn't want his stuff. He wanted his heart. But Herod couldn't wait for that. He had to make sure he preserved what he had right now. So if you read the Christmas story, which actually I encourage you to do. Most of us have sung parts of the Christmas story in songs, or we've seen bits of it on a show or a movie or something like that. But most of us have never actually from the Bible read the Christmas story. And I want to encourage you to do that this week. The thing is, what people don't realize is the whole thing can be read in like less than 10 minutes. There's two accounts of the Christmas story in the Bible. One is in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 1 and 2, and the other is in Luke, Luke 1 and 2. All those together, you put them all together and they sum up to like 5 pages or less. So I want to encourage you this week, and if you don't have a Bible, we have them out at the atrium. You can pick them one up for free at the Info Center. I want you to read that, Matthew 1 and 2 and Luke 1 and 2 this week. Take you less than 10 minutes. When you read that, I think you will see that a large part of this story was people who didn't have what they need, didn't have what they wanted, and they were waiting for this hero. Now, most of us, not a lot of us we can say are great, we're great waiting for stuff. I'm not so good with that. I think patience is one of the things that I need to work on. But I'm better at waiting when there seems to be a purpose to it. When there seems to be, I can understand, why are we waiting right now? Why does this have to be? And when will it be over? I'm a lot better at waiting when it's like that because I'm kind of just kind of the way I'm wired. I like to understand things. Even if there's a lot of information, I like to distill it down. And I like to understand it. So it's something a friend of mine has called synthesis thinking. And that piece has kind of serves you well in a lot of places in life where you have to bring order out of chaos. You have to take a lot of information and distill it and to be really driven by understanding and all the logic of it. Now, what I found is that kind of synthesis thinking that can really help me in some parts of my life. In other parts of my life, not so much. You know, and like, for instance, in times that are more, you know, kind of touchy-feely. You know, this kind of drive for logic and understanding doesn't always work. And it's caused some tension sometimes, you know, in my family. And I've often said at some point I'm going to write a book called Special Moments Made More Efficient. You know, and so it'll be all about Valentine's Day and, you know, anniversaries and Christmas and all that. Special moments made more efficient, you know. And so if you're not married, what you don't realize is that not all families grow up with the same Christmas traditions. And so when you get married, there can be kind of this clash of tradition. And Nancy and I found out early on that our families, for instance, we didn't have the same tree strategy. You know, we grew up with different tree strategies. So what I thought about going and getting a tree and what she thought, you know, was kind of totally different. So there was a clash of tree strategy and we kind of found a compromise, and that's been good. But then I found even within that, we also had different ornament strategies. You know, and actually what I need to say is Nancy actually has no ornament strategy. Let me just be honest about it. I feel it's important to have an ornament strategy, right? I mean, everybody has ornament strategies, do you not? And so it's frustrating for me every year when we go to decorate the tree and we haven't nailed our ornament strategy. Frustrating for me. We need to define our ornament strategy. It gets frustrating me before we put them on the tree. I can tell what a lot of you ladies are thinking right now, you know? Where can I get me one of these guys? I know that. I know that. It's a time of waiting for you. They're out there. Eventually. So my thing is, every ornament needs to have a meaning. It needs to have a meaning. So this ornament, oh, this little bell, this was my great-grandmother's. And it's made of plastic because they didn't make it of metal at the time because the war was going on and they needed to conserve their resources. Isn't that cool? Great story, you know. Or this one we got at our wedding, you know, or this, you know, kind of stories. And I love to tell the stories of the ornaments as we're bringing them out. You know, and I've found that over the years now, a lot of our ornaments, Nancy likes those stories, but a lot of them are like, this one was on sale at Target. You know, and that doesn't, you know, just kind of do it for me. So we have kind of a clash there. And now I found, as we're taking the ornaments out, new ones are popping in that I've never seen before, which it was kind of after the season the previous year. Nancy and the kids were out and they were buying some. So now, and I don't know if you've seen what's gone on in the ornament world in the last 5 to 10 years, but like stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with Christmas. People are now hanging on their trees, you know, which, again, you know, not part of my ornament strategy. So I'll pull something out and say, what is this Star Wars Hannah Montana Ozzy Osbourne ornament? Why do we need that? What's that have to do with Christmas? I like a purpose and clarity. I love to understand. And that has served me well in a lot of kind of my spiritual journey. Because a good chunk of our spiritual journey is about reading what God's direction for us, understanding it, and then applying it to our life. So I love this. I love that a lot of it's about understand and obey. Understand and obey. And I love that part of it. That definitely scratched that itch in me, that synthesis thinking of I want to understand and then I'll obey. I found though that there's another part to this journey as well that is a little bit more difficult for me. And it's kind of the flip side of this coin. And I've actually found myself probably more in this place in the last 6 months than I ever have been. And on some day, I'll share you kind of some more details about this. But in some of the stuff that we're passionate about here at Crossroads, I've been kind of at a decision-making point about some things, and it's involved some risk. It's involved some risk and kind of some unknown about some things. And so I've really kind of been struggling with that, and I feel like it's the right thing to do, but I need kind of more clarity. So my prayer has been about clarity and courage. I'm saying, God, I think for this, we're going to need clarity and courage, clarity and courage. And so really asking for that. And a couple of months ago, I was getting ready for this meeting in Washington, D.C., and right before I went in the room, I really felt like, boy, you need to be praying for this. You need to be praying for clarity and courage all the time before all these meetings they have. It needs to be about clarity and courage. And so I got home from that meeting that night, and, you know, kind of it's one of those nights where you're exhausted, so you fall asleep right away, and then you wake up in the middle of the night, and you're like totally awake, and it's like, you realize it's like 3 a.m, and I'm wide awake, and I realize I'm not getting back to sleep. I start praying, and, you know, first of all, I'm praying, God, help me get back to sleep. I don't want to be exhausted, you know, in the morning. And then I realize, you know what, this clarity and courage thing, God, I'm asking for that again. Maybe you woke me up right now because you really want me to be just focusing on this clarity and courage. And so I'm praying that, and I really felt, and this was not kind of like some audible voice kind of thing, but I really felt this understanding come into me that I really believe was God, and it was this challenge. Somewhat comforting, somewhat of a challenge, where I really felt like God was making me realize, Brian, I'm going to give you that. I'm going to give you clarity and courage. But I think when you're asking for this, here's what I think you're really hoping. I think you're hoping you get so much clarity, you don't need any courage. And Brian, I'm going to give you both, but I'm not going to give you so much clarity that you're not going to need any courage. And so for me, that challenges me to a different place that doesn't feel so natural to me in my spiritual walk. And that's this place where it's pretty clear what the right thing is to do, but it's not so clear how am I going to keep what I have right now. It's not so clear how am I going to avoid the risk in this. It's not so clear what the ramifications are going to be for me. I don't understand this. I want to kind of sort this out. And it's this really special, and it can be a really sweet place of our journey if we respond that way, where, yeah, there's a lot to our spiritual journey that's about understanding and obeying, understanding and obeying. This time, this is one of those sweet moments where God says, this is about obeying, then understanding. Sometimes we're called to obey and then understand. Any parent, you know that this is a constant thing with your kids. You want them to understand. You want them to understand the reasons for things and that there's connections. Also, you want them to have this underlying ability to obey even when they don't understand. Sometimes there's a need to obey and then understand. And you know what? When you read the Christmas story this week, what you will see is a whole lot of people who didn't understand. And they responded a different. Herod didn't understand. He didn't understand how if this rightful king to the throne was coming into the world, how he was going to keep what was his. He didn't understand that. And so he reacted out of an attitude of scarcity. He reacted out of an attitude of fear and an attitude of violence. And it ended up being his undoing. But he wasn't the only one in the story. Mary, it's described as that she was troubled. She was greatly troubled. And she obeyed. Joseph is described as afraid and obeyed. It's said that the shepherds were terrified and obeyed. The fact is, part of the Christmas story is that there are times when we need to obey before we understand. So I don't know, you know, kind of what season this year brings for you. Maybe for you, maybe it's this part of your life where you are at this place, and it can be a really sweet moment, depending on how you respond, where you're being called to obey before you completely understand. Maybe for you it's work, and you know there's this opportunity coming up where you are going to need to speak truth, and people in power are not going to like it. But you know that it's the right thing for the company. But you can't figure out how you're going to protect what's yours in the midst of this. And God says, this just might be that one of these times where you need to obey and then understand. Maybe you're at school and it is a frantic time of the year. It's a frantic time of the year and you've got that project that you're working, you've got that paper that's due and it's not easy and you can't see how you're going to get everything done this month that you need to. And so you're tempted on that paper just to kind of cut and paste somebody else's work. God says, this is one of those moments. What's going to happen if you obey and then understand? Maybe somebody has wronged you. And it's kind of one of those situations where they not only have done you wrong and broken the relationship with you, but they've gone and tried to trash your name to all these other people. And you're at this place where what's right and what's just keeps burning in you. But yet you stumble across these parts of the Bible where it says that we are called to forgive, no caveats. That forgiveness has absolutely nothing to do with the relative merits of the other person. It's all about you and your relationship with God. But it's so much easier. It feels so much better to hold on to that anger. Because it's almost the only thing that you have left. And God says, this is one of those times where if you would obey, then you would understand. Maybe you're married. Maybe you're married and things have got to a place in your marriage where, you know what, it's be honest with you, it's not one of the three most exciting things in your life. But there's somebody at work. Somebody of the opposite sex who just gives you a little bit more attention. They laugh at your jokes. They give you a little bit more attention and you're spending a little bit more time with them. And you know that there's a piece of it that's just not healthy. You say, but God, somewhere in you, you're saying, but I don't have this encouragement in life. I don't have this affirmation in my life. And at my age, you know, if I don't get that, I feel like I need that. I feel like I deserve that. But yet, you see some of the counsel that's in the Bible, and it talks about situations like that, and it says, flee. Keep to a path far from it. Do not go near the door. It's the highway to the chambers of death. And God says, this is one of those times where you need to obey. Then understand. Or maybe you're single. That's not easy. And you saw kind of during the sex series of how God has defined this incredible, powerful, wonderful gift of sex as something that is only reserved within the safety of a committed marriage. And not because he's trying to keep something from you, but because he's trying to protect your heart. He says that this is something that's only for within those boundaries. Yet you find yourself in another relationship, and once again, it's gone to that place. And you say, you know, but God, I understand that, but God, this might be the one. This might be the one. And if I draw a boundary in this place, I don't know how they're going to respond. And God, this might be the one, and I don't want to be alone. God says, I know. If you would obey, then you would understand. See, a big part of the Christmas story is that the secret to peace and goodwill is obedience while we're waiting. Obedience during times of waiting. Now I know for a good chunk of us in here, I talk about waiting, and it's not a hypothetical example. You know, this is not some interesting intellectual exercise, or you're waiting for some upgrade in your life, or you're waiting for some inconvenience to go away, or you're waiting for some difficult person to understand you better. It's not like that for you. This is a time of waiting. I have a friend who 2007 has not been a good year for him. And he has been hit with just about everything imaginable. And he is in regular, intense physical pain. And he and I exchanged emails yesterday. And the email he was sending me, he was typing it while he was in pain. He's waiting. He's waiting for relief. He's waiting for some release that will at least give him at least enough to move beyond the pain so that he can work and he can pay the bills. You know, some of us in here, we are waiting. Some of us in here, this year is one where it's a day-to-day thing. You know, things are so tight. Things are so tight that you've pretty much memorized what hours the creditors can call your house and what hours they can't. Things are so tight and you've lost a job or whatever that it is that you're just trying to get by. And you had an interview. You had an interview and you're waiting to hear. You're waiting to hear if maybe 2008 is going to be different. You're waiting to hear, did you get the job? Or not? Some of you in here, December, you're walking through December with a broken heart. Because the person you loved walked out. And you're waiting. You're waiting to see, is the door going to open? Are they going to come back? Or not. For some of you in here, it is physical. And your body seems to have turned on you. And so right now, you're waiting for the test results. You're waiting. Is the test going to come back clean? Or not? See, in everything that I have read in the Bible, everything that I've seen play out in my life and lives of the community around here is that right now you're at a particularly vulnerable spot. Because right now during this time of waiting, there are two lies that you are particularly susceptible to believing. First one, and none of them are new, they've all been around for thousands of years. The first one is the lie that Herod swallowed, is that all he had was the right now. All he had was the right now, and there's no such thing as anything else. When the story that we'll see, the truth of the matter is, this kingdom that God is building in the world, there is definitely a right now aspect to it. Absolutely, that's real. But this kingdom that God's building in the world, there's a right now, and there's a not yet. And the not yet is just as real as the right now in God's economy. The other lie, and this may be the most dangerous one of this, is that when you're at this place of waiting, right now, when you're waiting, when you're going into that hospital room and you're waiting, when you're headed into that corner office and you're waiting, when you're sitting down at the cafe with your ex and you're waiting, when you're going into that classroom at school and you're waiting, there is a lie that really preys on us at this time, and it tells us somehow in head. It says, well, I'm here, I'm alone. And on this one, you're on your own. And it's interesting that it really, that is a lie that really creeps up at this time of the year in a more intense way for people than any other time. And it's interesting because that completely goes against the absolute core message of the Christmas story. If you look at it, you know, from very early there, in Matthew, as it talks about this baby love coming into the world, what's it says? It says, the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel. Now, it's interesting here because sometimes in the Bible they use a word or a name, and you got to look elsewhere to find what that word or name means. This time it seems like God just painfully wanted to connect the dots with us. So it says, you give birth to a son and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. God with us. God with us. And so what God with us means is that love came down and there is no such thing as being alone. There are varying degrees of loneliness, but you are never alone. But it doesn't even stop there. There's even a more beautiful part to this. Even more beautiful part of this, because it's not just Emmanuel, God with us. Take a look a little bit elsewhere when it takes it even further. And Paul describes here the glorious riches of this mystery, which is Christ in you. And that's the hope of glory. We have glory within our reach. Why? Because Christ in you. In you. It's not just Emmanuel, God with us. That's great. But Christ in you? That if you're on this journey, if you're on this journey of wanting to understand what it is that Christ did for you by coming to earth and dying, and in whatever clumsy way you're pursuing that in your life, there's this Christ in you. And what that means is that God couldn't get any closer to you. What that means is that when you're sliding into that machine for that testing, God couldn't get any closer to you. What that means is when you're walking into that conference room, God couldn't get any closer to you. What it means is that when you're going back to that hard place for the holidays, God couldn't get any closer to you. That's the hope of glory that this season is all about. So you need to know. You need to know that when you're at these places, when you're at these places of waiting, and you're hearing that voice that's somehow telling you that it's all about the right now, and there's no such thing of the not yet, when you're at this place where you're hearing these voices that are telling you you're on your own, that you're alone in this, you need to know that that's a voice from hell. And that the story of Christmas is that love came crashing into the world for that very reason. Jesus came crashing into the world in a very messy situation. He left this earth in the middle of a very messy situation. And he spends time with us, a lot of people that are in very messy situations. So Andrea and Josh are going to do this song. And what I want you to do during this song is just to kind of listen to it as Andrea is singing it. And she's singing this as a prayer of truth to God. I want you to think about this. And if you want to start singing it just kind of in your mind here, I think this is one of those exercises where we go to where we will learn that the truth of the season is that love has come. And wherever you are, there's nowhere that you can go that God doesn't. Would you stand with me? God, we thank you that this is one of those things that not only sounds nice, but it's true. Help that to be the theme of the season for us. In Jesus' name, amen. It's true. Merry Christmas.